So welcome everyone to this session. I'm very happy to be talking with Mastin Kip. Hi Mastin, thank you for joining me.
Hey Alex, so excited to be here. Thanks for having me too.
So for any of you that don't know who Mastin is, just to give Mastin's professional bio, Mastin Kip is a number one best-selling author, speaker, and creator of functional life coaching for people who are seeking rapid transformation in their lives. He's been featured on the Emmy Awards show Super Soul Sunday and recognized as a thought leader for the next generation by Oprah Winfrey. Mastin has built a highly successful international personal development company that helps people create rapid change, connecting to who they really are and how to live their lives with passion and purpose. Through his writing, online courses, in-person seminars, and international retreats, Mastin has worked with over 2 million people in over 100 countries around the world. Oprah recently also named Mastin one of 100 awakened leaders who are using their voices and talents to elevate humanity alongside other teachers such as Tony Robbins, Caroline Mace, Deepak Chopra, Dr. Brené Brown, Marian Williamson, Eckhart Tolle, to name just a few. So, Mastin, thank you again for being here. One of the things I was saying to you before we started recording, what I really appreciate about your work is you're taking the work of a number of people which we are talking to as part of this event and your own ideas, and you're really looking at how to make that practical and how to make that applicable in people's lives. So beyond just being a bunch of theories and ideas, I know you're really into what works in the trenches of daily life.
Oh yeah, I mean that's the, you know, functional life coaching is all about what's functional, what works. And you know, the reason why I started functional life coaching, and it's very similar actually to this type, the work that you're doing in terms of the concept of therapeutic coaching, is how to blend this concept of therapy, which is people perceived as the past, with coaching, which is people perceived as the future, and how to blend those two things together to get results. And the thing that the past and the future have in common, it's kind of where those two places meet, is your nervous system. And all the work is focused there, and whether it's, you know, Dr. Vander Kolk or Dr. Porges or, you know, Dr. Levine, there's so many different people that we've either, you know, befriended, know, reference, and a ton of our own clinical distinctions as well. We're really focused on how to get actual results for people with a trauma-informed, nervous system-informed, polyvagal-informed approach. And it's super fun because ultimately what we're talking about is results.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think before we come into some of those pieces, it'd be good, I think, just to set some context here from the lens through which you're seeing things. So when you're talking about trauma, what do you mean by trauma? And why is trauma and a trauma-informed approach so important?
Sure. There are a million different definitions of trauma out there, whether it's Bessel talking about not being alive in the present moment or not being fully seen or heard or recognized. You could talk about Dr. Porges' definition, the context of it's a chronic disconnection from connection or safety. You could talk about it from the DSM perspective, which is more of this shock, abuse, neglect, wartime trauma types of things, or all the way back to Freud, right? It could go all the way back. My personal definition of trauma and our clinical definition of trauma is any experience that chronically dysregulates your emotions, your thoughts, your body, your health, or your spirit. So if you're in chronic dysregulation, spiritually, emotionally, physically, in any of those, you know, body organs, chronic illness, any of those types of things, that is the definition of trauma. And as I'm sure we've talked about in this series, trauma isn't just an event. It's what happens in you after the event, specifically when you're not in a safe environment, whether that could be, you know, holding an abuse underneath the rug, whether that could be suffering in quiet isolation after divorce, or whether that could be coping with the lack of certain, you know, secure attachment as a kid, with eating all kinds of inflammatory foods causing chronic inflammation in the body, and on it goes. So there's obviously the capital T traumas, you know, rape, abuse, neglect, et cetera, wartime trauma, shock trauma, all that type of stuff. But it's really the micro traumas and the small traumas that don't get addressed over time to add up. And those are things like when we're a child, you know, facial expressions from our mother, like before the age of two, that's one of the only ways that we can communicate. And if you have still face, if you have, you know, the caregivers aren't attuned, then the child feels missed, isolated. And when a mammal's isolated, well, that's a threat to the nervous system because we're going to be eaten by prey, right? So whenever there's that disconnection, that can be a traumatic experience, specifically if it dysregulates you from now on, if that makes any sense. So, you know, people who think that trauma is only this big stuff, you know, they don't really know exactly what it is. And if that doesn't really land for you, if you have depression, anxiety, guilt, shame, overthinking, perfectionism, procrastination, if you have imposter syndrome, if you have drama in relationships, any of those things, chronic fatigue, all those things, chronic illness, those are all symptoms of an underlying emotional and other types of trauma. So hopefully that's an all-encompassing broad definition.
I think that that's going to speak to everyone in some way and in some context. And I guess to come a little bit more then specific, and you sort of touched on it, but trauma lands and impacts upon the nervous system. And there's a sort of nervous system response that people have, be it those big T traumas or those micro traumas. Perhaps speak a little bit to that.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I got into trauma accidentally because I just started asking the question, why, to my clients. Like, you said you were going to go eat that way for the week. Why didn't you? Or you were going to leave that person. Why didn't you? Or you were going to go live on Instagram. Why didn't you? And after asking why enough, we got down to basically everyone's been through something hurtful. And I started to realize, well, you know, that makes sense. If you went through that and now you're scared of that over there, well, you know, that makes a ton of sense. And so I coined a phrase called survival patterns, which is basically everyone's trying to survive. That was 2011 or 10 or something like that. You know, a couple of years later, polyvagal theory comes out, explains everything in a much more articulate fashion. And Dr. Porges's context around things being an adaptive response versus a good or bad response is entirely spot on and completely lines up with all the clinical observations that I've made over the last, you know, 20,000 hours of working with people. And so what I firmly believe is that the nervous system, you know, has been around way longer than the DSM-5 or the APA or any type of stuff, right? Millions and millions of years. Every response we have has an underlying root cause that's based some version of our history that the nervous system doesn't realize that that's not now. It thinks it's the same time. And based on that understanding, it makes sense, which is why if we talk about something like psychosis, which people will say is a disconnection from reality, psychosis is a label that people use from the perspective of a caregiver or clinician. But for the individual going through it, it's very real because their nervous system is perceiving it. And so we have to have a lot more respect and empathy and understanding for people's responses. This is another example of classic personal development. I don't believe in a thing called limiting beliefs. Nobody wakes up and goes, oh my God, I want to limit myself today. But we wake up every day seeking safety. And so limiting beliefs, that's really, I think, almost shaming a trauma response. We just have to realize that people are trying to protect themselves. And as coaches and practitioners and therapists, anyone doing this work, our goal is to make someone's nervous system and perceived experience of the future safer so that they can move forward. And until we honor someone's nervous system response, we're going to be shaming them or, you know, trauma denying them unintentionally, and it's just taking them stuck.
And I think one of the things that happens when one, and obviously you've got a lot of clinical experience working with people with trauma, one of the things that one discovers is there is a logic to people's nervous system responses, as much as from a kind of typical kind of psychological analytical lens of people being kind of crazy or hypersensitive. There's often a logic to the way that people respond and those survival patterns that you mentioned that people have.
Yeah, the way I think of it is, if you look at if we go into attachment theory for a little bit, we understand like how especially mammals evolve, grow, and create safety and health, right? We have to be what's called attuned. Tracking facial expression, tone of voice, body language, all that stuff matters, right? And a good parent is attuned, not just physically present, not just a roof over the head, not just money, but attuned to the child's emotional state and helping the child make sense of the world. Well, you have to ask yourself the question, how attuned are the practitioners in the bodies giving us diagnoses to individuals? And I would argue that if you're creating a diagnosis or a label to somebody without understanding trauma, you're actually contributing more to a stigma than you are actually clarifying what's actually happening in someone's lived experience. And so we need to have a mental health system and a personal development world where people are more attuned to someone's response and to realize what you're saying is exactly right. There's a logical reason why this is happening. So for example, treatment-resistant depression is more a statement that that system has no idea how to attune to that individual than that something's wrong with that individual. Does that make sense?
Totally. There's a sort of crazy arrogance of traditional approaches, which is that if we can't find what's wrong with you, either there's nothing wrong with you or no one can find what's wrong with you. And there's something about that. When you really break that down, there's a sort of staggering arrogance really that's behind that perspective.
I think Bessel writes well about that articulately in The Body Keeps the Score, in the context of why the American Psychiatric Association had decided to reject the mountain of data that he put forward for a developmental trauma disorder, which basically means every other diagnosis in the DSM minus a couple medical ones would most likely be a secondary diagnosis to a developmental trauma disorder for most people. And you know, you have to ask yourself the question around economic agendas and things like that. But the thing about me is, and our work is that like we don't do diagnosis, we don't do pathology. We just attune. We help people understand, and we'll use some, you know, Peter Levine style language, right? We make their internal world explicitly stated so they understand why they're doing what they're doing. Not buried somewhere in their subconscious somatic, you know, sensations, but explicitly stated. And then their frontal lobes and their ventral vagal system can go, oh, that doesn't make any sense. And now we create a gap and start to bridge different parts of their personalities to really make it safer for it to move forward. And instead of judging the parts that are, you know, feeling guilty or shameful, or why do I have to do this, or whatever it is, we can start to befriend those parts of the nervous system in the context of building a business, getting into a relationship, getting out of a relationship, picking healthier food choices, whatever it might be. And we really focus on honoring those responses. And what's amazing is once you get to that place, you know, IFS, family systems, you know, Schwartz calls it your exile. When you get down to the conversation levels around, you know, exile style conversations, if you look at all the ways in which that young traumatized part of our personality coped, now we can start to realize my nervous system is freaking brilliant. Look at developmental or dissociative identity disorder. I invented 38 personalities to survive. Look how creative I am, right? Like that's more than books than Deepak Chopra wrote probably, right? So it's like...
and that's saying something.
I know, right? So I am constantly in awe of our clients rather than trying to shame them or put them in a box because, well, there are certain behavior clusters that might go and correlate to certain maybe diagnosis or certain patterns that we might observe clinically. At the end of the day, each person is individually and beautifully unique as well. And it's so important to have that focus. Hope that's answering your question.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think sometimes also people can negate experiences that have happened to them as a child because they didn't see them as being traumatic at the time. And I remember years ago having a girlfriend who'd had a sort of okay childhood, like nothing terrible had happened. It was just sort of okay. And I'd had some pretty bad things that happened in my childhood. It was fairly easy to go, that was traumatic. And I remember realizing and having this conversation with her, well, it was like, actually, it was easier for me to work through my history because it was like you could recognize that was clearly trauma. Whereas for her, there was this kind of subtlety in the fact that she was still close to her parents. They sort of loved her. They were attentive. They were caring. They just failed in certain ways, not because they didn't love her. They just didn't have those strategies and those skills. Yes. So for people that are watching this, that perhaps they're less familiar with developmental trauma, perhaps they're here because they've got a chronic health condition, for example, and they're saying, well, I had a good childhood. I wasn't sexually abused. I wasn't physically abused or whatever. What would you say to someone that sort of trying to make sense of it from that perspective?
Sure. I found, especially if someone's brand new, I found it very helpful to stop trying to determine if you have trauma or not, and instead focus on symptoms. Are you depressed? Are you chronically anxious? How dysregulated is your life, right? Are you on emotional ups and downs? Do you have a hard time moving forward? Are you stuck? Are you in constant depression? Do you have a chronic illness, right? If you have things like this, or do you have relationship drama? Do you have a hard time maintaining relationships, right? Like, are you, you know, constantly, I don't know, repeating the same mistakes over and over and over again? Are you stuck in some way, right, consistently? Those are all trauma symptoms. Now, what type of trauma? Well, it might not be shock trauma, like capital T stuff. But, you know, for example, you got very attuned parents who fed you high fructose corn syrup, and all of a sudden, high fructose corn syrup is what your nervous system interprets as love, but now you have a chronic disease, maybe of type 2 diabetes and chronic inflammation and an itis or two, right? Well, yeah, that all stems back to something, but you don't, like, think of an injury, right? You know, think, like, for me, you know, it's like you talk about like a sports player, right? Like, you know, baseball, I love the Dodgers, right? So a lot of times, like, you know, pitchers have to go out for Tommy John surgery because of an elbow, something that's like an elbow injury that's even preventative, right? That's a trauma. But we don't wait for like their arm to fall off and say, well, maybe they should get surgery, right? So just because something's obvious and big, that's certainly easier to identify, but you want to look at the symptoms and you want to realize if I have these things, there is an underlying emotional and mental and physical root cause. And those are also traumas. And the other thing is that, you know, and Bessel really talks about this in Body Keeps the Score. We didn't know this 5 or 10 years ago at large. Clinically, it's only been maybe 20-ish years, right? For like the most cutting edge people, right? You go all the way back to the work of, you know, William James, who thought that basically psychology was a soft science because you couldn't measure any of this stuff. This is all new phenomena that we've been mapping over the last 100, 150 years, taken to context that average, you know, research takes a minimum of 20 to 30 years ago mainstream, right? We didn't know, right? We didn't know, okay? I mean, if you think about the Ten Commandments, okay, which is like a pillar of Christian and Jewish faith, one of the biggest ahas in the Ten Commandments is don't kill each other. Okay, that's like, and we haven't even gotten that far yet, right?
We're still working on it.
Like, yeah. So like, we have to understand that like, the nervous system is a lot more sensitive than we think. We're much more vulnerable. We're also stronger than we think. But we're recontextualizing trauma because we're coming out of, you know, shorter lifespans. We're coming out of, you know, acute illnesses like the plague killing the whole world. And now we have chronic issues, right? And you can't cure or reverse chronic issues with an infectious mindset, a pillar, whatever it is. And so we're understanding the nervous system at a whole other level that honestly, we didn't even have the luxury to afford that long ago because we didn't live long enough to realize it.
Yeah. Yeah. And also we were just trying to survive, right? It's almost a sign of the evolution of the species that we can start to pay attention to some
That's
of
right.
the subtleties.
That's right.
Can you say a little bit about the relationship between emotional trauma and an inflexible nervous system? Like we sort of touched on both of these, but actually how does that relationship work?
Sure. So I, because I'm a coach, right? I work with people who are both clinicians and then also lay folk and or, you know, called B2C, regular human being, consumer type people who are just trying to change their life. I work with both. And what's really interesting is that whether you're a clinician who's done, you know, you've got your master's, your psychology, PsyD, your PhD, LMFT, all the alphabet after your name, right? Or maybe you're a person doing who loves personal development, spiritual work, and you've got EMDR, CBT, DBT, LMNOP, all that stuff too, right? And you're still not getting the results, okay? Why am I doing all this hard work and not changing, right? The reason is because your nervous system does not want you to take risks that could potentially hurt you or create any type of uncertainty. And what that means is that our nervous system gets frozen in certain responses. So if you look at polyvagal, the polyvagal ladder, we know ventral, sympathetic, and dorsal, which is like a kind of like a stoplight, green, yellow, red, right? Basically, we get stuck in yellow, which is sympathetic affect, stress, go, make it happen all the time, different versions of that. Or red dorsal, which is immobilization with fear typically. And those are more of the depressive responses, isolation responses, downregulated responses, and you know, bipolar is just, you know, yellow, red, yellow, red, yellow, red, yellow, red. And we want to bring the ventral vagal system online, which is that prefrontal cortex. It's the myelinated part of the vagus nerve above the diaphragm that creates social engagement, happy tone of voice, you know, executive function skills, all those things. And what happens is, because as Porges helps understand, there's a hierarchy, right? If I can't negotiate my way out of a, you know, or use diplomacy to get out of this problem, then I go yellow, sympathetic, which is I'm going to kill you or flee. And if I know I can't escape, then I go dorsal, which is red immobilized. And the problem is ventral goes offline. So our prefrontal cortex goes offline. Our ventral system goes offline. All the good thinking goes offline. Our sensory motor rhythm, which creates our felt sense of presence, goes offline. Our midbrain, which is optimism, goes offline. And then we're just stuck in these very short window responses of stress or quit in very different formats. And then eventually, if we try and try and try and nothing happens, then we just go dorsal, which is more of a depressive, invisible response. And it's very hard to get out of those things because you don't even know that you have these different hierarchies of the nervous system. They're too busy being pathologized. And there haven't been strategies since polyvagal theory to really get more, quote, ventral. So what we do with clients is, we help them go up and down their ladder where they go dorsal, they go sympathetic, they go ventral, sympathetic, and dorsal. They kind of go up and down the ladder. And what that creates in the nervous system is a sense that I can go to a depressed place or an anxious or scared place, but I don't have to live there forever. And as a child, when we had these early experiences, the situation was typically so overwhelming and we felt so powerless that, and it was at that point our entire life, we felt like we couldn't escape depression. We couldn't escape anxiety. We couldn't escape these dysregulated emotions. And then maybe we get a diagnosis and that's our identity all of a sudden, and I can't get out of it. And so the inflexible nervous system means that you're stuck in a very small range of responses. And the more nervous system flexibility that you can have to feel safe and in danger and sympathetic and then sort of more immobilized and kind of be able to go through those different blended states, things really start to shift and change. And what's really beautiful about the work that we do is we help people reduce the frequency, the intensity, and the duration of these responses. But more importantly, it's not that we help them never get dysregulated or never get stressed, or never get depressed. We help them understand that when they go there, they have more agency than they realized and that they can come back from it. And I think that's really the sign of mental and emotional and spiritual health and physical health is it's not that you don't get dysregulated, it's that when you do, you can come back faster. And so an inflexible nervous system gets dysregulated, but can come back faster.
Yeah. So
I'm sorry, flexible nervous system.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're in a sense, you're teaching people not to just be a victim of the circumstance or the events that happen. You're teaching that ability to change gears, which I think is critical to then also not living in a state of fear. Because I think often what happens with trauma is there's trauma and then there's the fear and the anxiety about the trauma. And after a while, people become a victim to that.
Yeah, I think it's hard for me to use a word like victim because there's such a like victim and words like limiting belief, there's so much around it. But you're absolutely accurate and correct. The language that I would use is that we help people rediscover or discover for the first time their agency, which is they can have an internal effect on the world and that they're not at just cause, right? And that's because when someone's in a trauma response, especially early on, they haven't learned that they have any agency.
Yes.
They don't even know that they have it, right? When they realize they have it, there's a whole other set of problems that come with it, right? Because usually, if I didn't have agency and now I'm learning how to, that means all of my formative relationships are now threatened, even if those people are dead, because now all those systems were set up for me not to have agency. But what's amazing is that when they realize that they do have agency and they can take those, you know, those actions associated with it, they meet their nervous system. But instead of going, why am I freaking out? They go, oh, I know you. You're my friend, right? You kept me safe when I was 5. Thank you so much. Hey, did you know I'm 38 now? Let's move forward. Right. And it's a very different response than just having to, you know, say, well, you know, let me believe, reframe it or, you know, whatever. And I also think that, you know, coming out of that sort of sleep, if you will, it's important that, you know, I think Peter Levine talks deeply about this is the idea of an empathetic witness, right? To say, hey, this did happen to you and to be there as long as you need to be there. But it's very important to not stay there because even though it can feel really good to get validation for your wounding and your trauma, that has a lifespan, shelf life. Because if all you do is you stay stuck with just, oh my God, I'm so sorry for you, then you're not actually getting into purpose and getting into what you're supposed to be doing with your life. But it's an important phase that you want to sort of pass through.
Yeah, yeah. And I want to come on to purpose in a second. But I think before we do, something else that's also important here is that you can't resolve and you can't heal trauma in a purely cognitive way. And I think that's one of the things that I think you're emphasizing here as well is the importance of the heart and the importance of actually being connected emotionally to the impacts of the past, not necessarily being defined by those, but being in touch with our felt sense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just gonna say something, okay? The term mental health is the wrong freaking word, okay? Now, you might be doing an EEG scan and looking at brainwave patterns. You might be trying to measure neurotransmitters, okay, and all that stuff that happens here, right? But, you know, Porges and anyone who does the HPA access knows and microbiome knows that, like, our body, especially if you look at the vagus nerve, 90% afferent fibers, meaning from the body to the brain versus efferent fibers from the brain to the body. So when we look at, like, the original bidirectional communication, is there bidirectional? Yes, but it's mostly guts up. Right? All the neurotransmitters are produced down there for the most part, and they come up, right? So if you look at like a dysregulated brain in an EEG scan, you're looking at an after effect of the viscera's impact on the brain, as well as what's happening in the brain, but it's 90% body to brain. So if you don't get the body on board, I don't care how much cognitive behavioral therapy or personal development reframing you do, that shit is going to be a platitude at best. You're going to be like, that didn't work, right? Or you'll comply because you want to impress your therapist or coach, right? You've got to get the body on board, which is why the book is called The Body Keeps the Score. Bessel is very intelligent in the way he framed it. And so, and that also speaks to Porges' concept of phylogenetic, meaning it has to happen in the right order. If I don't get the body on board with my dorsal sympathetic systems, my subcortical systems, there's no way I'm going to be an executive function, making good decisions, visioning for my life. I'm going to be stuck in rumination, dorsal depression, generalized anxiety, and different versions of that. And when I get my body on board, well, guess what happens? All of a sudden, you know, magically the brain is so much more improved. And quick example on this, I do clinical neurofeedback every day at my house. If I eat inflammatory foods, my low beta waves, which I'm trying to train up to be more present, impossible. They just tank, right? If I eat alkaline and anti-inflammatory, they're naturally 10 times higher, right? And so it's like, is it really mental health? I don't think so. I think it's somatic and emotional health, and mental health is sort of an after effect in a lot of ways. It's important, but it's, you know, it's not the origin.
And I think actually that categorization as mental health says a lot more about the people that we're categorizing than actually what it is that they're observing and looking at.
That's right.
Mastin, you mentioned purpose, and I know that one of the key pieces of your work is looking at this relationship between trauma and the impact of the past on living and fulfilling one's purpose in the present, in the future. So maybe can you open up a little bit how that relationship works and why that's so important?
Sure. So I am in many ways similar to Bessel and everybody else. I love any modality that works, right? I don't care if it's neurofeedback, trauma-informed yoga, kundalini yoga, anti-inflammatory diets, like whatever it is, right? All those modalities are great, but you have to ask yourself the question, why? Why am I doing this in the first place? And it's so clear in the literature. If you go to PubMed, you type in purpose in life, thousands and thousands and thousands of articles come up, okay? What do they say? When there's purpose in life, you have better recovery from trauma. You have better improved all-cause mortality reduction, meaning anything that can kill you likely kill you less. You can extend your life up to 10 years. You have improved financial abundance, not just in the short term, but over an entire decade, longitudinal studies, right? So if you look at blue zones where centenarians live to be over 100, having a purpose is like a foundational piece. So if I'm just doing, you know, somatic experiencing, or if I'm doing dialectic behavioral therapy, or if I'm doing neurofeedback, those are great tools. But why do you have a tool belt in the first place, right? The purpose is so that you can do your thing, what you're born to do in the world, right? To get unstuck and actually make that happen. So what is purpose in life? Purpose for me starts as an emotional state. Any goal that you set, whether it's financial, spiritual, relational, you think there's gonna be an emotional payoff. You want the money because of how it's gonna make you feel, you know, connected or abundant or certain or safe. Same thing with a relationship. You wanna have passion in your life or whatever it is, right? Connection. And so purpose starts with understanding how you wanna feel. And then figuring out what vehicle do I want to bring that forward in? Do I bring it forward in business, relationship, nonprofit? Like, what do I want to do? Maybe it's a kid. However I want to raise a child or family, whatever it is. And that means if I lose a business, I still have purpose. If I lose a child, God forbid, I still have purpose. So you don't lose purpose. You find different vehicles for it throughout your entire life. But your purpose ultimately is to figure out how you want to feel, upregulate that, and help other people upregulate their emotional states as well. That's basically what purpose in life is all about. And what you want to do is realize, can, somatic experiencing help me get to that end? Can applied polyvagal theory help me get there? If the answer is yes, use it. If it's not, dump it, because everybody has a different buffet of tools.
Yeah, and I think often, I mean, thinking about that relationship between trauma, healing trauma and connecting to purpose, I think also often people have dreams. They have things that they, you know, deep down when no one else is looking or listening, they kind of fantasize about this thing that they want to do, but they have so many stories and so much, I guess, emotion and, you know, survival patterns, all of this stuff that's in the way of that, that that's completely obscured. And there's no chance of that coming forth without having some resolution here.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, a client is a classic example would be a practitioner. You know, let's take someone I can think of who has a, you know, PhD and a PsyD, one of our clients, okay? Like, so smart, okay? Like, can diagnose and crush it and change lives. You ask this person to go live on Instagram, deer in the headlights, right? You ask this person to raise their rates financially, deer in the headlights, right? And all these reasons come up that are valid based on the history of this person and why they can't, right? However, you take the same person, you put them in a movie theater, God forbid, okay, when we all come back, okay? And then the movie theater catches on fire, right? They're not gonna sit there and go, you know, I need to know the burn rate of the actual fire to what its burning ratio and how much oxygen is being consumed and CO2 is being put off. And, you know, is Mercury retrograde? Oh, it is, okay, maybe I won't get up. They go, right? They have to make it happen, right? So we have the ability to actually mobilize, right? What we have to do is make it safe to mobilize versus making it a threat to go away from. And purpose is something that gets you going, right? So you can take someone who has all the diagnoses in the world, but if their child is in danger, they will rally and make some stuff happen. What happens is, I think the majority, my personal opinion, which is not based in clinical peer-reviewed study, okay, just my experience with 20,000 hours of working with people is that all these other issues that we have, these diagnoses, the core of it, even below the diagnosis of the trauma, even below the trauma is a lack of purpose. Because if I have purpose or meaning, and I can understand that that was horrible, but it has a meaning to it, like Viktor Frankl talks about in Man's Search for Meaning, right? We can overcome trauma. I mean, that's what Viktor Frankl did in Auschwitz. That's what Oprah Winfrey did with her life and all of our clients who are survivors that are now thriving, right? So the core isn't even to have a diagnosis or even understand how to have trauma. It's why am I gonna go do this? What's that motivating factor? How do I wanna feel so I can feel that way? And then giving myself disconfirming experiences so that my nervous system can start to believe it's actually possible. But without that core why, we will be stuck in all kinds of, you know, responses, and there's not gonna be a good enough reason to change. But when you have a good enough reason to change, you're gonna do it. And when you find, especially meaning in the trauma that you went through, everything can change, everything can change.
And of course there are some people which will say, I don't know, that they've read every book on it, they've done every workshop, but they don't know what their purpose is. How much of that do you think is just a response to a shutdown, like a nervous system, like in freeze, can't connect emotionally, or what are some of the other reasons why you see people that just get stuck at that fundamental question?
Well, a couple of things. People have to be ready, because people will seek out the practitioner that will help them go as far as they feel safe going. Right. So when someone comes to me, they're ready to like dive into the deep end. Right. But what I will tell you is that I think it's a lack of awareness on the clinician's part, because the personal development, whatever, spiritual, mental health community has told people you have a purpose. That is not true. Right. It's not that you have a purpose. Purpose is not a statement. It's a question. What is my purpose? And we go live that question. There's no arrival point there. Where you, okay, my purpose is to be X. That's improper training. It's a question that we live. And how should I put this? It's important that at least once a decade, you really aren't clear what the answer is, because that means you're growing, right? But there's no arrival point. So it's a constant question that we're living, this idea of what is my purpose in life. But if you maintain a focus on how you want to feel and how you want to help other people feel, that's a guidepost, because you may or may not know the answer to this esoteric question of what is my purpose, but you can certainly say, yeah, you know what? I want to feel connection today or excitement today. And even if I don't think it's possible, at least it gives me something to focus on that's tangible versus this, in many ways, unanswerable question. And it's all about emotional regulation. And that is, we've come into the present moment with that. So sometimes getting lost in what is my purpose is just a survival response that says, if I stay in confusion, I don't have to move forward, versus moving forward with a half-answered question.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to come into some of the kind of practical pieces of, we've touched on some, but of working with this. So when you're working with someone one-on-one or in a kind of group program, what are some of the strategies? What are some of the tools that you're using to help work with people's nervous systems?
Well, the first thing is, I believe that appropriate psychoeducation is very important. So the first thing we do with anybody is we teach them polyvagal theory 101. Right? You have a ventral vagal system, you have a sympathetic nervous system, you have a dorsal system. I have a guided process that guides them through a felt sense of what each one feels like. So they don't just got it here cortically, but they have a subcortical experience of it, right? And that becomes an anchor point. The next thing that we do is we help them resource what's called secure attachment. What does that mean? It means we help them remember times or relationships where they felt really safe, really connected, really taken care of. And we anchor that in the body. And then we look at their goals and where they want to go. And then when they start to pursue those goals, we help them resource that secure attachment. We help them remember that they're riding this polyvagal ladder, right? And then eventually what we do is, and this is very supervised, I have a process I've created called traumatic memory deconstruction and resolution. And what we do is we regress people to their root cause traumatic experience, and we help them claim agency over that experience. And so it's a sort of a non-ordinary state guided process that we do in groups and individually. And they go back, and because they have this agency in their nervous system where they can know they can go up and down their ladder, and they feel safe in depression, they feel safe in anxiety, they feel safe in happiness and all the above, they've resourced secure attachment. When they go back to those places, they can go back to those places with agency and with tools and with a prefrontal cortex. And when you experience those memories over again with agency, that's a huge part of starting to start to heal those things. And now that I understand this is what's happened to me, I can see a cascade of, because of this, these were my nervous system's expectations and neural beliefs. Because of that, these were the appropriate emotional responses at that time. Because of those emotional responses, these are the thoughts I was having. Because of those thoughts, these were the behaviors I was having. And then what we help people do is the exact opposite. So it's like, okay, here's all the stuff you did to get dysregulated and to kind of stay safe. What would the opposite start to be? We list it out, and then we help them start to take action in that direction. In the context of when stuff comes up, why does it make sense? How is the nervous system responding to this old pattern? Is this an old pattern, or is this a necessary concern? And we help them become more explicit in that. And as that happens over time, they become sort of more automatic and starting to realize, like, hey, that was just my history, right? And we don't look at our clients as broken, fragile people, especially ones who have intense trauma, because if they went through the trauma and they survived, those are some of the most resilient people we've ever met. So we treat them with a ton of honor and dignity. And I'm constantly in awe, but that's sort of the basics around it. We also will throw in, references to functional medicine so that they can have less inflammation in their body, heal their gut if they need to. Maybe refer them out to maybe aiming clinics or something like that to get a SPECT imaging to understand what's happening in their brain. Maybe we get them over to like a neurofeedback. It just kind of depends on what's happening. Then I sort of quarterback all those experiences for people. And then obviously if they're going to build their business, we teach them online marketing, all that type of stuff. But in the context of their nervous system, not just here's a strategy to move forward. So there's lots of different things that we do, but it always starts with sort of that initial psychoeducation, getting into the felt sense, getting into the trauma, and then moving forward.
I really like what you just said about not treating people that have been through trauma as broken, delicate people, because I think one of the things which is a kind of question in my own mind sometimes is it sometimes feels that the more trauma-informed everyone becomes, the more people kind of walk on eggshells and pussyfoot around and be really afraid of triggering and upsetting people that have been through trauma. And I'd be curious to hear a bit more about how you sort of navigate that tightrope of holding that place of genuine kind of compassion and sensitivity with that kind of more, I guess, feminine quality, with that also kind of more father quality of like, you know what, you handled it, you can handle this. This doesn't have to
be. Sure.
Like, how do you navigate that tension?
Well, my number one goal, first of all, as a clinician, is to make sure that my nervous system is regulated. If I'm dysregulated, I'm probably going to dysregulate my client no matter how much I know. Okay. So I'm always making sure that I'm as regulated as I can be. Then when I'm working with somebody, my number one focus is to create dyadic or between two people safety between me and that person. And then to be as attuned to that person as I can be. So I'm constantly monitoring facial expression, tone of voice, body language. I'm hearing the words that they're saying, but I'm mostly looking at their nervous system responses. And depending on the context of what's happening, there is absolutely a time to treat people with an extreme over sensitivity because what they're going through is very, very sensitive. And we absolutely do that. However, a big difference between our work and lots of other people's work is that we bring a lot of irreverent and certainly humor into what we're doing as well. And if you look at the biology and the biochemistry, the biochemical opposite of trauma is humor and fun and play, right? So we bring a ton of play into that because I'm coming with you, like, oh my God, I'm gonna hurt you, and right? Like my expectation that the client will conform to that, right? Versus if I treat you with respect and oh my God, look what you did and holy shit. Oh my goodness, right? Game changer. One of my favorite things to do with people after we've gone through a regression, it's been very difficult, and they've maybe talked about trauma for the first time, is I ask them a question. I say, "Who do you think it would be possible to ever authentically laugh about this? And I'm talking rape, incest, abuse, like the worst of the worst. And the answer is always, no way, dude, like you're crazy. Like, okay, well, how long, if you were to laugh at it, do you think it would take to actually authentically have a laughing experience associated with this? And they think, oh, 10, 20, 30 years, whatever. Like, okay, how about 5 minutes? And they're like, this is crazy. So I get them into this whole process. Usually it's in a room with people in a little group. And I kind of get all serious and I say, there's this very important mudra that we do. And it's a spiritual mudra that I learned from this ancient yogi, whatever person. It's all bullshit, right? But I'm just trying to create the context. I get everybody to take their finger like this. And then I have them point it out in front of them like this, the whole room. And then they spin it around 3 times and it goes right into their nose. And everyone puts their finger right in their nose. They can't help but laugh. And I go, tell me the story again. And they tell me the story again and they're laughing hysterically. And that is a complete disconfirming experience in the context of that story. Their nervous system will never forget. Right? Now, that has to be done in the right context with the right safety at the right time. Right? But that's something that someone who treats someone with this sort of kid gloves would never do. Right? But it all is about context and how attuned you can be to someone's nervous system and to understand when it's appropriate and when it's not. And you have to have humor. Because if you can't get someone to a place of actually authentically laughing at some point, then you're not really getting trauma resolution.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I totally. Someone said to me many years ago, the more serious you become about your problems, the more serious your problems become. And there's something about that, you know, and of course the person, I guess, most famous this is Tony Robbins and his ability to just bring humor to places that if you don't understand the context looks insane, but actually done the right way is enormously powerful.
Well, and if you look at Tony, right, which he's had some missteps in the last couple of years in the context of understanding trauma and patriarchy, okay? So for sure, there's a growing edge for him in this context, right? He learned from Bandler and Grinder and NLP, but they studied Milton Erickson, right? And you go all the way back to Erickson or all the way back to Fritz Perls and Gestalt or all the way back to Virginia Satir and family therapy, right? And like kind of those three, right? Which is what all that comes from. What did they all have in common? They all had attunement. They were all attuned to their clients. They all followed their nervous system of their clients. And specifically, Milton Erickson had tremendous respect for the person, an individual, to be their own therapist. Right? And so I just think that when you look at the greats and the originals, you know, they weren't getting all these CEs and trying to catch up with the system and fit in and all that type of stuff. They were just with people. And it was much more innovative and much more, I would say client focused than it is today. But if you follow the nervous system and you bring humor to it at the appropriate time, like Erickson showed us how to do that back, you know, so long ago, and was picked up by lots of people, including Tony, I think that that's a really, really powerful thing. Now, it's not the only thing, because here's the thing. If you're not attuned and you miss that person, then you're shaming them, right? So it has to be the right place at the right time, which requires a lot of skill to be able to do that. But it's absolutely necessary, absolutely necessary.
And I think it's also, there's something clinically about being willing to take risks. And if you have enough, if you've built enough trust and safety, you can misstep, but you can feel when you've misstepped and then you can bring that into the room and you can work with that.
Well, and not only that, like if you look at attachment theory, right, part of healing relationships, therefore healing trauma, is that it's not even about not messing up, it's about the repair.
Right.
Right. All the trauma healing and relational healing comes in the repair process. So as a clinician, if you can be transparent about that and be willing to, you know, own your own mistakes and then be able to bring that to the place and then actually repair with people, that's amazing. You know, last year I was doing Clean Your Power Live in Atlanta. And I had a conversation with a gay man about Christianity and sort of the experience of what it's like to be gay. And we talked about it and we got to a really great place. But at the end, it didn't quite land. Like I felt like I missed him, right? So at the end of the seminar, it was a 4-day seminar, at the end of the fourth day, after it was over, I just said, hey man, you want to chat? And I listened to him. I know I missed something. What did I miss? And boom, opened up so much, right? And it was such a beautiful thing to go, holy cow, of course. I missed this and I missed this and I missed this and thank you so much. I'm so sorry. And he was like, who does that? Right. But like, I think that it's okay to miss if you're willing to kind of, you know, swallow your pride or think you realize you don't have it all together and actually listen to human beings. And that's a really important piece as well, is to be able to have that repair process because you'll grow as a clinician.
Yeah. And I think it's also, it's as I think you, what the point you're making, that's what normally hasn't happened with the people that have caused trauma in the first place. Is unless we're talking major big T trauma, often parents, they love their children, they're just stressed and they're tired, and in that moment they're not particularly skillful. But if it can be responded to, and there can be the kind of the healing on the other side, there isn't trauma in the same way.
Yeah, and the term for what you're describing is called a disconfirming experience. It disconfirms the original trauma, because when you go through a trauma and then you relive it over and over and over again, every time you relive it, that's a confirming experience. See, all men are cheaters, or no one loves me, or whatever it is. But if you can create a disconfirming experience that's literally the opposite of all that, that's when the nervous system goes, what do I do with that, right? And sometimes being attuned or repairing or acknowledging when you messed up can absolutely be a disconfirming experience for people that didn't get that before.
Mastin, I'm mindful of time, but people that want to find out more about you and your work, what's the best ways to do that?
Oh, thanks, Alex. Yeah, so I'm just at Mastin Kipp on all the networks, right? Instagram and Facebook and everything. And then MastinKipp.com. And then obviously Claim Your Power Book, use ClaimYourPowerBook.com. And there's a free 40-day coaching experience along with that too, to help you really focus on finding your purpose and resolving your trauma along the way.
Awesome. Mastin, thank you so much. I really appreciate not only your kind of breadth of understanding of many different of the kind of pieces of the jigsaw, but also the practical way of bringing it together. So thank you so much for making the time to share with us.
Thanks, Alex. It's been a pleasure. Great questions. And thanks for having me.
Great. Thanks, buddy.